Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, this is always among the most exciting and challenging and wonderful hours of the whole year for me when it comes to the morning show. The opportunity I have to sit across the table from half a dozen wonderful cartoonists from across the country and from various aspects of the industry. It means that it's time once again for another Kenosha Festival of Cartooning. This is the sixth such festival. And Ann Morse Hambrock, who is the primary organizer of this event, has assembled, I think, maybe as fine an array of cartoonists as have been arrayed for any of these events, particularly in terms of excellence across the board and in terms of the scope of their collective accomplishments. So I'm really excited that they can be here in our studios for the one of the first events in what is a several days worth of events going on here in Kenosha. Let me introduce who we have with us today. I'm going to try to go in order here. Eddie Pittman is the guest that my niece Lorelei is the most excited about because she happens to be a ferocious fan of the animated series Phineas and Ferb. And Eddie Pittman served as both a writer and story artist for that and did animation for Disney on a number of different films, including Mulan and Tarzan and several others. And an animator of the first rank who has recently created something that was really quite groundbreaking, an animated film for a planetarium. Done other exciting things that we will talk with him about. Eddie Pittman, it's great to have you here.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here.
Right next to him is Rob Harrell, who is responsible for an absolutely delightful strip called Adam at Home. Earlier, another strip called Big Top. He got started very early in this, and he's also begun creating a series of books for middle school. And I don't know what it says about me, but I really love these books. So they speak to me, and even more importantly, to middle school readers, called Life of Zarf, which we'll talk about as well. Rob Harrell, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Next to Rob Harrell is Ann Telness. She is an editorial cartoonist for The Washington Post and a Pulitzer Prize winner, if I understand correctly. And she has done outstanding work in the field of editorial cartooning and also has some background as a designer for Walt Disney Imagineering. And she has experienced the glories and also some of the dark side that is involved in being an editorial cartoonist of the first rank in this day and age and culture in which we live. And, of course, it's this hard-fought presidential campaign has been an especially intriguing time to be an editorial cartoonist. So we have a lot to talk with Ann Telness. We welcome you.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. I'm very happy to welcome back to the morning show, and for the first time in person, Wiley Miller. And I'm sure many of you enjoy his well-known strip, Non Sequitur, which is syndicated to over 700 newspapers across the country. I spoke to Mr. Miller over the telephone. John Hambrock thinks it was about 10 years ago about one of the published collections of his works, and excited to have this Reuben Award-winning cartoonist here in the studio, Wiley Miller.
It's great to be here, thanks.
Good to have you here. Next to him, Jen Sorensen, who does a really marvelous, hard-hitting strip that touches on all kinds of different issues of importance and interest to a wide swath of the American public. It used to be called Slowpoke. Now it just bears her own name. She is a past winner of the Herblock Prize, named for the legendary editorial cartoonist Herb Block. Jen Sorensen's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Good. That was loud and clear. Good. And we already mentioned that John Hambrock has figured in the very first of these festivals back in 2011, and he is back as one of the guest cartoonists. He's, of course, from right here in Kenosha and responsible for the strip, The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee. Welcome back, John.
Hey, thanks, Greg.
Good to have you here. Can you just say a word, although this festival has, I hope I'm not mischaracterizing it as saying that this has really been primarily the hard work over the years of your wife, Anne Morse Hambrock. But I know you've played a very significant role in making it all happen. What's your perspective looking back on these six festivals now?
Well, she has done a remarkable job. And I look back and I marvel at how she accomplished everything that she did. I mean, you have to get artists, you have to get venues, you have to raise money, there are a million little pieces that need to be put into place to make this successful. And if you leave out even one or two of those pieces, it's a domino effect. It could just create havoc, one day or the other. And I cannot, and this is honest truth, Greg, I cannot remember anything over the past six festivals that has gone wrong, really. I mean, everything has gone so smoothly, and that's because Anne's attention to detail is remarkable. My role in it is just, okay, well, what do you need? And I go and I do it. Mm. And she directs me in every aspect of what needs to get done, and I try to make sure that I get it done.
Right. I have to say that over these years, one thing that has remained pretty consistent is that everybody who's come has been nice. And that's not to say everyone's been bland. I mean, also people have been really interesting and fun and
well, we're
intriguing.
Nice people. We like to think we're nice people. we all get along. It's family. We're all family.
And as we were, before we started our conversation, somebody out in the hall was saying that the world of cartooning is actually a relatively, I think that was you, yeah. Mr. Miller, saying yeah. It's a relatively small world.
Yeah, it's easier to become a pro ball player in any sport than it is to become a cartoonist. If you look at the numbers.
Right. So those of you who managed to make this happen for yourselves, you're a relatively small group, and there's probably certain opportunities where you actually get to interact and even meet.
Yeah, well, in the very old days, most of the cartoonists lived in the New York area because that's where all the publishing was, especially the magazines and all that. And over the years, we started to spread out as we're able to do our work from other areas, have FedEx and all that.
Right, right.
And so we just gradually started migrating. So it's actually more difficult now for us to get together. Mm. That's why events like this are so important for us. Because it's the one time of year that we're able to be in a room of other people who speak the same language. Because usually we're the only ones in the entire city who do what we do. So we can't go out, after work with our other people we work with and, bitch about our job and all that. Because they look at us and say, what's your problem?
Right,
draw pictures.
It's not the same as emailing.
No. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, you sit around a table and you really, really get to know each other more and can swap some war stories and some horror stories and some glory stories too.
But also that's what's so important about this festival, which is why I was thrilled to come here, because it's not just cartoons getting together, having fun and enjoying yourself. It's getting together with kids because that's so important for them to actually meet cartoons, to see that we really exist. It doesn't just magically appear on the internet or on newspapers. That's how it started for me, getting to meet a cartoonist and say, oh, yeah, it's a real thing. I can do that. So I think it's really important for that.
Yeah, it's served a great purpose. And young and old, but particularly children, it's great for them to kind of have a sense of this stuff does not just magically appear on the page as though from shoemaker's elves. It's a person.
Piggybacking what John was saying about the work Anne has done, I've aged 10 years just thinking about the amount of work she has to do to put this together. It really is an amazing feat.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine doing that.
Right. So glory be to Anne Morse Hambrock. And before the end of the hour, we will spell out all of the different events that are going to keep all of you very, very busy for the next couple of days. And again, we thank you for resisting the urge, the temptation to sleep in this morning and to join us here on the morning show. I think we're just going to kind of go around the table and get to know each of you sort of individually, although chime in as you feel inspired. But I'm anxious to talk with each of you about various facets of what you do. Let's begin, actually, with Eddie Pittman, who has worked at least primarily in the field of animation. So cartooning that's not just on the printed page, but exists on the screen. I know that some of your earliest professional work happened right at Walt Disney, so that's not a bad place to begin. Is that actually where your career began?
My animation career began at Disney, and that was certainly, you know, because that's the major leagues for in the animation world. And I started as an in-betweener, which is the bottom, you know, entry-level position, where you do the drawings in between the animator's key drawings. So you kind of make that movement smooth, bring that that action to life. But it was a great time. I started on the movie Mulan, and worked on Tarzan, and ended on Lilo and Stitch, and it was a good time. Mm.
So, for instance, if I took out, I know you worked on Fantasia 2000, which I absolutely love, right?
I did.
Okay. So if we took that out and we watched it together, would you be able to say, I did that, or is that?
Yeah. Fantasia 2000 was very interesting. I only did two scenes in that movie where I put there was a sequence, Beethoven's Fifth, and there were these flying Doritos or something. I think they were abstract butterflies, but I called them the evil, dark corn chip Doritos. And what I did was I put that scene on ones, and what that means in animation is, originally that scene was one drawing for every two frames of film, and that's called on twos. So you have 12 drawings for every second of film at 24 frames per second. And a lot of times when you do that and there's a camera move, it stutters a little bit. There's a little bit of strobing effect. So they needed me to put that scene on ones and just go in and put in an extra drawing. Mm. That's all I did, and they gave me a credit on the film. I worked for 6 months on Lilo and Stitch and left before it was finished, and they didn't bother to give me a credit. But so that's the funny political side of animation.
Absolutely. Well, of course, what is probably at the top of your resume is the work that you did on this absolutely delightful series called Phineas and Ferb, which, of course, lives on, even though I don't think new Phineas and Ferbs are being created as far as I know. But just say a word about what it felt like to be part of such a brilliant program.
Well, by the time I came on to Phineas and Ferb, which was in the fourth season, the groundwork had really been laid. We're not a television watching family. We don't watch broadcast television. We watch Netflix and stuff. So I knew about Phineas and Ferb because we live near Disney World, but I didn't know anything about the show. And I didn't realize that I knew one of the creators of the show and known him for 20 years.
Ah.
And I got a Facebook message out of the blue that he wanted me to come work on his show. And I was hesitant at first because the last time I'd seen him, he had worked on Family Guy, which is a fine show, but I kind of make it a policy to only work on things that I can share with my family.
Right.
And so I wasn't sure, and before I said no, I watched the show and went, wow, this is... Actually, the first time I watched it, I went, what is this? The second time I watched it, I went, oh, now I get it. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit slow. I called him, and he said, I want you to come out and write and storyboard on my show. And I said, aren't there any writers and artists in Los Angeles? And he said, yeah, just not a lot that do both.
Mm.
And he remembered a comic strip that I'd done in college. He did a comic strip at USC, The Daily Trojan, and I was doing a comic strip at the same time at Georgia State University. And he remembered my comic strip, and he remembered it as being funny, which it wasn't. But because he remembered it as being funny, he said, I want you to come, and I think you could bring something to the show.
So his sketchy memory is why
exactly.
You got that job.
Yeah, Dan Povenmire is his name. And he's also the voice of Dr. Doofenshmirtz.
Yeah, right.
Well, Eddie, you also did a voiceover on Phineas.
I did. Probably the proudest moment of my life. I play the voice of Darth Vader in the Phineas and Ferb Star Wars episode, which was a childhood
dream.
Could
you do that for us right now?
And, you know, all those years of, as a kid, talking into a paper cup actually paid off. So, my line in the film was, and you know, it loses something here on, you know, without the effects, but it was, I find your lack of socks disturbing.
Mm. So. Yeah, that's pretty chilling. Very good. And by the way, when you were back at Disney doing those first films, was that the old-fashioned kind of animation?
Yeah, it was back in the days of hand-drawn animation. Wow. You know, the computer was still used at that point. We were using an ink and paint system that had been developed by Pixar. But we still drew on paper.
Right. That's one thing that collectively over these past years that's been interesting again and again is how those of you that are in this field right now have lived through such a transformative time in which it was once done one way and now done another. Not just in the field of animation, but all of you have had ways in which the work you do or how it's disseminated is dramatically transformed. I hope we'll have time before the end of the hour to find out about this intriguing planetarium film.
That's ancient history now. That was 15 or 10 years ago.
Sounds neat, though. We should just say a word about it then, since you're going to be shy about it. It's a full 360-degree dome animated film.
Yeah, made that for a company that does laser shows. It actually pioneered laser shows in planetariums like Laser Floyd and some of those back in the 80s. And they did a full dome projection animation. So we created an environment, 360 degrees by 180 degrees. And no one had done that, as far as we knew, of using hand-drawn animation.
Right. And, of course, now that immersive experience happens quite a lot. But this would have been one of the first times
I did it before Glenn Keane, just not as well.
Right. Well, that's exciting stuff, nevertheless. Well, it's great to have you here. Next to you is Rob Harrell. And I'm excited to talk with him about his really clever and heartwarming strip called Adam at Home. I read in your biography that you got a very, very early start in this. Tell us about some of those earliest efforts back in Bloomington, Indiana.
I had my first magazine that I started back in fourth grade called Freak Out Magazine. And it was my friend Chip Walton and I, and We offered subscriptions to our magazine for a quarter, and I got all the kids in the fourth and fifth grade to buy subscriptions, and then we ended up just putting out one issue. You know? And it was pretty much just a ripoff of Mad Magazine, and then my parents made us give all the quarters back.
I read that reviews were mixed. I mean, that's the way you characterized it.
Yeah, and I look back now, and I can't tell which jokes I actually wrote and which ones were just completely, you know, pulled from the pages of Mad.
Yeah, plagiarism in its most raw form.
Finest, yes.
So was it sort of a steady crescendo in the sense that you obviously loved drawing then and just got more and more interested? Or at some point, was there a catalyst where you suddenly became incredibly focused and interested in really doing this?
It was fourth grade. It was this magical moment when and my parents tell the story that I told them in fourth grade that I wanted to be Gary Trudeau. Mm. And I find that unlikely because I was, you know, eight. And I don't think, you know, Doonesbury hadn't been around that long. But that's what they say. So since then, I continued to do cartoons for the, you know, the middle school yearbook and the middle school paper, and then I had a regular strip in high school and in college, and then, you know, I've sort of fumbled around throughout my career trying to find what it was I wanted to do, and it hasn't been a straight path, let's say that, but it's always involved art.
Right. So at one point, you scored your first syndicated comic strip, a strip called Big Top, which I remember, actually. So I'm not sure where it was that I saw that, but I remember it vividly. And now you have currently you're doing a strip called Adam at Home that I like very, very much. What's that like to sort of have a strip run its course and then close and then a new strip begins? I mean, do you get to have like a final episode the way a television series does when it goes off the air, or just one day does it stop?
No, it was. I knew that it was coming, there were a lot of reasons why Big Top ended, and I loved doing Big Top, so that was a painful decision to do that. But I did have fun with the ending, and I sort of, the last week, sort of played out like the very end of the movie Animal House, where I told what happened to each of the characters as they went on, and then the final panel was them walking off into the sunset with credits rolling, that sort of thing. So, it was. Cool. I had fun with it and tried to be as cinematic as I could with the end of it.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Adam at home is a guy named Adam and his wife and his, I think, two kids. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful example of a comic strip that mines gold out of mostly the really ordinary stuff of life. And in some ways, I think when people look at a strip like that, even if it's as consistently clever and entertaining as yours is, I think it's the kind of comic strip that's easy to underestimate, that it seems like it would be simple to create, and I suspect just the opposite.
First off, I should mention that Adam at Home is a strip that started in the 80s. It was Brian Bassett, a fantastic cartoonist, started it, and then I was brought in to take over the art duties, and then at one point take over the writing duties as well.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and so it was the syndicate that contacted me to see if I was interested in doing that, and they assured me that I could put my own flavor into it, my own spin into it, and it's been a lot of fun. It's a challenge because it's a different kind of. I think Big Top was more naturally what I do. At one point I sent the trained poodle, went to Mars. There were no rules, and then doing a family strip, you have to work within the confines of reality a little bit more. A heightened reality, but. So I've had a lot of fun with that, and there's a lot of me in there. My family shows up in there quite a bit as we the dumb things we do end up. And then so anything that happens, I think people cringe because they know, that's going to be next week's strip.
It's going to be in the strip.
Right.
And you've also begun creating a series of books that are so delightful called Life of Zarf, in which we meet a troll by the name of Zarf, is it Belford?
Yes, Belford.
Who is himself or itself a student in middle school. And you have drawn some absolutely fantastic parallels between the standard middle school horrors that so many middle school students experience middle school as it plays out in this kind of fairy tale land. Did anything in particular prompt that?
I just think middle school was such a vivid time. I just remember it so well, and I think so many changes happen when you're in middle school. I remember, for example, it was the first time I had a friend that my parents didn't like, there was something just magical about that. they thought he was bad news, and I just felt, you just start to come into your own. Just suddenly, you're not as much your parents' child as you become your own person. And so it's a fun time to write about, and it's been a lot of fun to take fairy tale characters and sort of figure out where they fit in that. And so the example that I use is Goldilocks is now the lunch lady. Miss Lox, the lunch lady, the bully who he really can't stand is the prince, and so if he gets on the wrong side of the prince, things don't go well
right.
for him. So.
And the ogres are the jocks, and the band geeks are the minstrels and so on.
Yeah,
you've created something really, really wonderful there, and I could see that going all kinds of different directions. I mean. Living on or expanding onto screens. I sure hope so anyway. Created something very special. Right next to you is Ann Telnis, who is a cartoonist for the Washington Post. What a time to be a cartoonist for the Washington Post. That's quite extraordinary. Tell us what drew you into this field in the first place, editorial cartooning.
Oh.
As opposed to all kinds of other things that you might have done.
Well, I actually did start as an animator.
That's right, at Disney.
Well, I went to the California Institute of the Arts, and I learned the traditional hand-drawn style as well. Worked a little bit for Disney Animation freelance. And then I went to, as you mentioned, Imagineering, which is the the branch of the Walt Disney Company that creates and designs the theme parks.
Ah.
Yeah. So I was a show designer there, not animating. But
so, and what do you mean by designing show, like the live performance things that we would see on a
the
stage
rides,
there?
The
or
rides.
The rides.
Yeah.
That's what you
and
mean.
Everything I drew, I think one thing was built.
Wow.
I did a lot of blue sky drawings, conceptual stuff.
Okay. But I mean, so the way a ride would appear?
Well, the concept for it, you know, like the story behind it, you know, the conceptual, you know, sketches.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's funny, you just don't think about a person doing that.
I know,
and yet, obviously,
there are
a person,
people that do that. Yeah,
lots
yeah.
of people, and very, and needless to say, very talented people.
And I worked with some really wonderful people, and I did that for 6 years.
Wow,
and,
fun.
But at the same time, I also did freelance on the side.
And by the way, at Disney World, what can you point at and say, that's my baby. That's
it's gone. Sorry.
Oh, no.
Like I said, one thing was built.
No. Oh, I got you.
It's
right.
gone.
Oh, and it's gone.
It was actually at the Universal, the studio tour.
Okay.
Yeah, not the Universal, the studio tour. So, anyway, so to make a long story short, because it is a long story, I was just doing freelance work at night while I was still working at Disney.
Wow.
And I had the television on, and this was 1989. And the Tiananmen Square massacre happened right in front of me.
Wow.
And I was so, I was appalled, frankly, at watching it. I wasn't very politically aware at that time. I didn't read newspapers. I was in my 20s. I wasn't really interested in it. But that really kind of awakened me to want to learn more. So I just started reading the newspaper and, you know, educating myself. And then by the time we got to 1991, some of you might remember the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings, which had quite an effect on me because I was a young woman who worked, you know, in business and had experienced sexual harassment. So, you know, I decided, you know, I really, you know, I need to start speaking out through my art. And that's when I put together a portfolio. And,
wow.
and I kind of fell into it, because if I had known how hard it is and what a difficult profession it was and how few women were in it, I don't know if I would have done it.
Wow. Yeah. Well, fortunately you did, because you've obviously done superb award-winning work. You've also experienced what other editorial cartoonists certainly experience from time to time, but it's never been more true than it is right now. That is that you might create a drawing, create an editorial cartoon of some kind that really provokes a enormous backlash of criticism. And in this, you wrote about how we live in this era of the social media that just seems to sort of prime the pump or stoke people's very visceral reactions to that. Do you find that in any way is a stifling effect to you creatively, or in a sense, is it doing just the opposite? Do you feel like are you experiencing kind of a freeing of your creative instincts?
Well, let me be clear. I mean, editorial cartoonists, we are a very thick-skinned bunch. You know, we take criticism. We've had it for a long time.
Right.
I've been in this business for 20 years. It's not something I am not used to. The difference is now, because of social media and the access that people have to it and how fast it is, it has changed the dynamics of criticism. I'm not complaining about criticism. I can take it. That's
right.
Not the point. The problem is I've never received so much misogynistic stuff as I have in the last couple of years.
Right.
And, you know, it's a way of trying to silence you, which makes an editorial cartoonist very angry, because we don't want to be silenced.
Right. And that's the heart of my question.
Yeah.
Is that which occurs now, which a guest on my program recently termed gender trolling, where this particularly seems to happen in this with this misogynistic attitude and aim towards women. I mean, it is done, at least to some extent, in the hope that it will silence you or tame you.
Yes.
And my question is, what is its ultimate effect on you, actually?
Don't do that to an editorial cartoonist, because all they'll do is they'll just be louder.
Right. That's
you know,
what I...
So, but at the same time, I also feel a responsibility as someone who's been in this business this long to hopefully the younger women coming up to speak up and say, this is garbage what you're doing, you know, and we're going to fight back. So, you know, it's just something we have to deal with. I'm only speaking out about it because I believe so strongly in free speech, but at the same time, you know, threatening someone is not free speech.
Right.
That's the line right there.
Right.
You can say anything you want. You can describe me as any C word you want to use, but you can't threaten me.
Right. So. Right. That's the difference. Let me ask you something that's a little... Yes, absolutely. There's all kinds of things to talk about. One of them is that you not only create kind of the standard political cartoons, but you also do certain animated cartoons. Yes. I mean, the ones I've seen are... limited animation, I mean,
yes.
And I don't know, maybe sometimes they really play out more like a short little cartoon, but like there's one of the Supreme Court justices and they're all bobbleheads, and so their heads are moving up and up and down, and a couple others sort of like that. I'm just curious, when did it even occur to you that that would sort of inject something new and interesting?
Oh, you have to come to my presentation to hear that.
Ah.
It's on Saturday. We're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
No, but as you know, like Eddie was saying, you know, classical animation is 24 frames a second. Obviously, I'm not going to do that because I'm doing these very quickly. That was one of the reasons when I first had the idea to do an animated editorial cartoon from a, you know, because I was in print for 15 years before that. I had to sit there and think about how does that translate? You know, how do we do this? And like I said, I will talk more in depth at my presentation on Saturday, but I've arrived at using GIFs, which are very simple, very social media friendly sharing pieces. And I use my training to figure out how to do that in a quick form. So I love it, and I love to tell young people, and I'm gonna tell you know any young people that come to this presentation, this is where you have to realize that everything you learn in life will come back at some point.
Hmm.
It's not like you have to sit there and say, oh, I'm gonna use this, I'm gonna you know use my animation down the road, but learn everything you can. Because it's all going to contribute to your development as an artist.
Right, just makes you richer.
It does, and I'm just, everything I've done has always come back and helped me at some point.
I like that. I like that a lot, and I agree with you completely. That's wonderful. The man next to you, Wiley Miller, who primarily is known for his comic strip, Non Sequitur, you have a background in editorial cartooning as well.
Yes, and Non Sequitur is actually a hybrid. It's a growth out of my editorial cartooning. It's where I blended together all of my experiences, just what Dan was talking about using all of your experiences. I just put together my experiences as an editorial cartoonist, a magazine gag cartoonist, and a comic strip cartoonist, and blended it all into one mishmash, which is why I called it Non Sequitur.
There you go. Do you, in this fascinating time in which we live, are you ever envious of Ann Telness or Jen Sorensen, who, in a sense, are all the time in a more sort of full-throated way editorial cartoonists? Do you miss that at all?
Well, because I still editorialize. I just do it in a more scurrilous manner, going under the radar. And I found that it's far more effective, I think, gets more reaction to do it in a comic strip and just... and do it in a different way of getting a point across than on an editorial page where people are, first of all, few people go to the editorial page, and that they're expected to see something. So when it comes out of the blue like that on a comic page, it has that much more of a visceral reaction. Gary Trudeau talked about that years ago, because Doonesbury has been run on the editorial pages, a lot of papers, and he says he much prefers being on the comic page because more people will read it, you will actually see it, and it has that much more of an effect.
I suppose in a sense your defenses are down when you're reading the comic
exactly.
page.
That's
I mean, right below Peanuts is
right.
or whatever.
And so I'll get that visceral reaction that we were just talking about with Ann, but I never get the kind of reaction that Ann has gotten. What we're just talking about, the gender thing, that takes it to another very awful level. People will write to me, you know, calling me all kinds of names and you're an idiot and all that. You know, we're used to that, but they don't attack my masculinity or anything like that. And it's just a whole different level of trying to shut you up. Because one thing I noticed about all of these the hate mail is they scream and yell a lot and call me names. One thing they never do is say you're wrong. They never present anything to, you know. You know, if I say, you know, the sky is green. You say, well, no, it's blue. Take a look. It's easy to correct. And, you know, when they can't present something,
it's not about a counter argument.
Right. They can't come up with one because they see that it's the truth, but they don't want to admit that they're wrong. So instead, they try to silence you by yelling at you. That's the way of the internet now.
Right. Your strip non sequitur is I don't think anybody even around this table would object in saying that it demonstrates an exceptional artistic mastery. I mean, in terms of the level of detail and the intricacy of what you draw, and just the fact that so often it's at a diagonal and from above. I mean, it's not just this kind of flat on thing that the vast majority of strips. And not that there's anything particularly wrong with that, but you really have a distinctive visual look even beyond the words that are there.
Yeah, a lot of people called it it's the God's eye view. You're going up and it's giving a different perspective. Because I started out doing it as a single panel, but in the strip dimension. You know, that is I figured out that was a better sales tool than trying to do the traditional square panel. I found that in order to fill out that long horizontal, that it's better to raise that camera angle up so that you're looking down, and it spreads it out in a more panoramic, natural manner instead of trying to force things out. The other thing I did, or actually didn't do, is I don't put a box around it. So I let the art play out, so using white space to fill that space. So when I first started out, people kept asking me, how come your strip is run larger than everybody else's? And I said, it's not. It's just an optical illusion. It's using the white space of the art. So it's learning those graphics, just what Anne was talking about, of taking things that you've learned in the past, you know, start out from the newspaper as a staff artist and have an art background, and just learning how to do things and observing how other cartoonists do it. My biggest influence was Mad Magazine growing up, and especially Mort Drucker and the mastery of the art that he did. So that had a huge effect on me. And unfortunately, while I'm sitting there for hours drawing these detailed cartoons, I went, why couldn't I come up with something simple like Dilbert?
There you go. It would take seconds to draw instead of hours. For instance, today's strip is a lady in a bakery, and it's an intricately drawn bakery. I mean, we see every little cupcake in the window and every little donut and so on, and we see plants in the background and the window to the street and so on. And essentially, all of the joke is in the tiny little sign right in front of the display case, which says, caution, floor slippery because of drool.
Right.
And it's just kind of interesting because, you know, you're making the choice to devote I don't know how much time to create that whole bakery and all of the details, and then just this little joke right in the middle of it. And there's other people who wouldn't make that same choice.
Right. Well, I'd like to – what this does by going to that perspective, it immerses the reader into the cartoon. So it makes you part of it as a reader. I never thought of it that way until somebody pointed that out to me. that's what I do. But because I don't – think about these things. I don't analyze my work of how I go about it. I just, you know, do it. If I think about it too much, then I'll screw it up. you get that left brain involved. No, you're going to ruin it. But it's something I developed when I was working as a staff artist and editorial cartoonist at the Santa Rosa Press Democrat in California, and I'd walk to work every day. It'd be about, 20, 30-minute walk. And while going there, I start off, in the morning, I have a cup of coffee at home, scanning over the newspaper, reading it, and seeing what issue I want to be, dealing with. And so while I'm walking to work, I'm composing the cartoon in my head, saying, okay, what do I want to do? What should I do this? So by the time I got to work, the entire cartoon is in my head, and I just draw it out. And I've worked that way ever since. I don't sketch anything. I compose everything in my head first, and then just pencil it out and then ink it. So.
Wow. It's funny you make it sound almost simple, which is exactly what it's not. Yeah. But it's what works for you, obviously.
Yeah, everybody has their own process, and that just happens to me. Other people like to sketch a lot and all that. but I can't do that.
So
I
your wastebasket has nothing in it,
no.
Is that what you think?
No, no, no sketches. Because I get this all the time. Oh, can you send us your sketches for display or something like that? I don't have any, sorry.
It's all up here.
There's no blue lines on my final art and all that. Yeah, and I still work completely pen and ink. I don't do the only thing I do on the computer is color, yes, and scan in the cartoons and send it to the simulator. Right. That's it.
Hmm. Well, it works. It absolutely works. Jen Sorensen is next to you, and she has done a strip for about 15 years, once upon a time called Slowpoke, now no name at all. Jen Sorensen, you studied cultural anthropology in college. How do we draw a line between that and what you do now?
Yeah, that's correct. For years, I was studying anthropology and thinking I would go to grad school for that. But, because I really liked just observing culture and observing people and asking, well, why do we do that? I don't like taking anything as just normal. I like understanding what drives that behavior. And so when I got out of school, I was a little tired of academia and tired of writing papers, and I had always drawn comics for school publications, and that had always got me more attention than anything. So I figured I would put out a comic book. And I did that after college. And at that time, alternative weekly newspapers were a growing industry. And I decided that I would try to pitch a strip to local papers in Virginia, where I was living at the time. And I actually managed to pick up a newspaper in Richmond, Virginia, called Punchline, which was kind of like The Onion, maybe a little more punk rock. But it no longer exists, sadly. But they started running my strip. This was in the late 90s. And then from the Funny Times, which is a humor publication that runs a lot of cartoons, started publishing my work. So what I like to do, getting back to the anthropology question, is I'd say there's just so much in common between anthropology and cartooning in that you're sort of sitting in the back of the classroom observing, you're just sitting at the margins watching life, and then you make your statement on it. Hmm. And I think that it actually served me very well, perhaps even better than going to art school in terms of writing political cartoons.
Hmm. Your work also has a very distinctive sort of look to it, albeit its distinctiveness is quite distinct from, for instance, what we were talking about with Non Sequitur. Has it had that particular look right from the start? And what do you think about it makes it so effective?
I think that it does look a lot like the comics I was drawing as a kid. It was probably influenced the most by Life in Hell by Matt Groening.
Oh, yeah.
And Robert Crumb. I guess I was reading these things in college. And so it probably does look a little more cartoony or underground comics-y than a standard political cartoon. But I find that allows me to, I don't know, I feel like it's a very free style. It's very simple, and I can do some imaginative things with that.
Absolutely. Now, for instance, what does your wastebasket look like compared to Mr. Miller's?
It's full of scraps. Yeah. My process involves just brainstorming on pieces of paper, and they can be quite messy, and there'll be several sheets that I'll be recycling at the and I know people say you should save them because they're valuable, but if I did that, my house would just be a mess.
There you go. I need to ask you and Ann Telnis about the fact that you are doing what you're doing, and anybody else is welcome to join in on this, but I really want to make sure to just take a moment to ask the two of you about the fact that this is a historic presidential campaign on a couple of different levels, but in particular that we have a woman as a major party candidate for president. I wonder, in the video that I watched that the two of you participated in Philadelphia, you both actually spoke really articulately about the position that you are in as women in this field at a time when a woman is running for president. Have you felt yourself kind of wrestling with like sort of conflicting feelings or emotions about this and trying to decide what the most important thing is for you to say artistically in what you do?
Jen, go ahead.
Well, you know, over the years, you know, I've done cartoons about Hillary. Critical cartoons. I guess I criticized her for her Iraq war vote. More recently, however, I do find myself in the position of wanting to defend her. Even though I have mixed feelings about her, I still I am very excited to have the first woman candidate for president. And I think a lot of the misogyny and sexism directed at her is very upsetting. And I mean, I personally believe that she is far more competent than Trump. So, it's an objective truth. Okay, it's not even a personal belief.
Yeah.
So lately, you know, I do find I'm defending her, and that can be difficult. In that, I think there's a lot of people on the left who get upset when I have a lot of readers who do not like her. And they criticize me for that. And I think the conflict just comes from, you know, trying to have this more complicated worldview that I feel like I have. And everyone wants your worldview to be really simple.
Mm.
Yeah, I think definitely I'm with Jen here that, you know, there's plenty to criticize Hillary Clinton about. I mean, I criticized her about her war vote a long time ago. I've covered her since she was first lady, but even while she was first lady, I could see, you know, the sexism that would come up and the different standards she was frankly held to. She has a lot of problems, but you know, I want to see her criticized for issues. Mm. I don't want to see her criticized because she looks tired or she gets sick. I mean, this is nonsense what we're seeing now.
Exactly.
And it's going to get worse if she becomes president. I can guarantee you, if you guys think racism came in after Obama became president, you wait. Mm. The sexism is going to come full force if she's president. So I look at it as, yes, I'm just as excited as Jen is. I mean, I want to see a woman president.
Right.
It is way time.
And do you think the fact that some of this is being talked about in the way that it is that in any way a constructive thing? I mean, does this have the potential of advancing us as a culture?
Absolutely.
Past some of this? If some of this is, in a sense, brought to the surface, albeit sometimes in a really ugly way.
Yes. I mean, I think the more we talk about it, the better. We have to. Mm. And I've done cartoons on it already. Yeah. Mm.
Well, let's say it should make things better.
Right.
The amount of vitriol we see about this, and from these areas of the really hardcore Trump supporters, who there's just no talking to about that. You can't get them to see their misogyny, and they think it's perfectly fine that, you know, everybody should have their place, especially, you know, the races and the genders. They have their place. Let's go back to making America great during the Mad Men era, where.
Well, we have weighty things to think about in terms of the work that you do. And, of course, on the other hand, you're also in the business of entertaining and delighting and making people laugh, making people think. And all of those various facets of what you do will be explored over the next several days in this newest Kenosha Festival of Cartooning. We want to explain that, first of all, coming up tonight at 6 p.m., does that sound right, John? An opening reception at UW Parkside?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. For the exhibit, editorial cartoonist Taming the Tigers. So this is in the Matis Gallery. So this is at UW Parkside, right up the road. So that reception at 6 p.m., the presentation is a panel discussion on the role of editorial cartoonists. Friday speakers at the Kenosha Public Museum will include John Hambrock and Jen Sorensen. Saturday events, Bending the Lines, Women